This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm one of the producers here at The Briefing Room. And recently, the BBC obtained some exclusive pictures of British special forces on the ground in Syria. That's despite the fact that officially, there are not supposed to be any British troops on the ground in Syria at all. So why are they there? Where else are they? And why can they operate without a parliamentary debate or a vote? These are some of the questions that intrigued us here at The Briefing Room, and we set out to answer them. Here's David Aronovich.
Hello. Earlier this year, Sarah Elizabeth Williams, a reporter working for The Times in Jordan, made a discovery.
The story goes back to January 2016, the beginning of this year, in an area called the Rukban, which is in the far, far eastern stretch of the Jordan-Syria border, where you had a pileup of more than 10,000 Syrian refugees. Now, there's an old Jordanian military base out there, and the press were given access to some of the refugees, but not in this one area. And I thought that was a little bit odd. A month later, the new Syrian army deployed into southern Syria. A month after that, the US Department of Defense referred to having used these HIMARS rocket systems, these very powerful rockets, from the Jordanian base. So that told me, okay, it's not just the Jordanians up there who are doing some pretty significant things. I then spoke with insiders and slowly put together a picture that indeed, not just American, but British special forces were active up there and going over the border into Syria.
This week, the BBC obtained exclusive pictures showing British special forces operating in Syria. They were shown carrying sniper rifles, heavy machine guns, and anti-tank missiles. So today, who are the special forces? Where exactly are they being deployed and why? And who decides? To find out, follow me into the briefing room. Inside, I have a panel of experts, and I'm going to talk to former Special Forces soldiers here in the UK and on the line from America. First, though, I have some basic questions, and to answer them, here's the BBC's Mark Urban, Newsnight's diplomatic and defence editor and author of several books on the Special Forces. Mark, when we say UK Special Forces, what are we talking about?
I suppose the simplest way of defining it is those who've passed UK Special Forces selection, which happens in two great bouts each year, and they go to one of three units. The SAS, which everyone has heard of, the Special Boat Section, which fewer people have heard of, it's the Royal Marines one, and the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, which almost nobody has heard of, because it's only just over 10 years old, and it has a covert surveillance role.
And how many people are we talking about?
Really, you're talking about around 1,000 in total. There are various other people they call enablers, intelligence people, the people who bring in the air support, the helicopter crews, various people like that who might also be packaged up as special forces. When you actually find them on the ground, though, the numbers tend to be much smaller. So even an operation by a whole squadron of the SAS or SBS, you might be talking about 50 or 60 badged people and about 30 helpers of various kinds.
They are people who are given the best possible intelligence. That intelligence, by its nature, is often fleeting. So if you imagine that an individual is being tracked on a lonely road in the Pakistan tribal areas, having troops that can respond to fleeting intelligence opportunities, maybe 40 minutes, maybe an hour or two after you've got that first information, requires very, very highly skilled forces. And that's the sense in which they're special.
Are there any women involved?
The special forces are one of the key areas where the recent decision by the government to allow women in combat will have a significant impact. There's a caveat there, though, which is the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, which grew organisationally and historically out of an organisation that used to operate in Northern Ireland called 14 Intelligence Company. That was its cover name. Always employed women because it was found useful to have them on the streets of Northern Ireland as mixed teams, you know, husband and wife, as it were, conducting an observation less obtrusive than a load of fit-looking men in their 30s. So there is precedent to having women in special forces, but now they're going to be able, in theory anyway, if they can pass selection, to get into the SAS and SBS as well.
They're supposed to be able to do something that conventional troops can't, which is blend in. How successful is that?
I think one can say that the special forces post 9/11 had a rather difficult learning experience with this. Because of their long operations in Northern Ireland, they had come to consider themselves rather expert at blending in, at being in hedgerows and having people standing 2 feet away and not realising they were there, all that sort of thing, being on the streets, following suspects, some very impressive and brave operations. Of course, they soon discovered when they went to Iraq and Afghanistan, it's far more difficult for, you know, Jed from Northampton to blend in on the streets of Basra or Kabul. I remember being in Fallujah at the time of a significant operation there by British Special Forces, and the commander of the American battalion I was with said, oh, yeah, we had them here just a couple of days ago. They're very impressive, he said, very impressive. They were all dressed in Arab clothes. And then he left a pause and said, mind you, they all had the same big watches and boots on, so they were pretty easy to spot.
Mark Urban, Newsnight's diplomatic and defence editor. Now joining me in the briefing room are Emily Knowles of the Oxford Research Group's Remote Control Project, a body which studies new methods of warfare, and Dr. John Moran, expert in security at the University of Leicester. John Moran, why don't special forces count as boots on the ground? We seem to have enormous political debates, even if we're going to have airstrikes, let alone if we're going to have forces put on the ground. And yet we put special forces into places and somehow or other nobody says these are boots on the ground.
It's very closely related to whether there is a formal legal declaration of war or not. If you're in a conventional war, what the human rights lawyers call an international armed conflict, that usually involves you deploying large-scale forces in order to defeat those of the enemy. Special forces can be deployed in all sorts of conditions, what the British military and other people called OOTW, operations other than war.
Sorry, is that a real thing?
It is a real thing. I've not just made it up. That can be a conflict that could be anything ranging from a hostage rescue to a counter-terrorist operation to the SAS functioning as trainers for local paramilitary groups. The deployment of special forces allows you to do things under the level at which you have to declare an internationally recognised armed conflict.
Emily Knowles, what are UK special forces doing right now around the world?
Well, I suppose the first point on this is that it's very difficult to know. The UK has a blanket opacity policy in terms of commenting on the use of special forces.
A blanket opacity policy?
Yes. It basically means that any time the media reports any use of special forces, there's a MOD statement that goes out that says that it has been our long-standing policy not to comment on the use of special forces. However, this has not stopped emerging stories coming out, particularly in Libya over the last year. In February, there was a Mirror story released that the SAS were spearheading a secret campaign against ISIS in Libya, for example. Then you had that rather unfortunate leak of a meeting conversation between the King of Jordan and senior US congressmen that basically said that the King of Jordan committed to his special forces joining UK special forces on the ground in Libya to work together, which basically proved that UK special forces had been operating on the ground since at least January 2016. Since then, there have been a couple of media stories out as well. There was a recent one in May about the SAS blowing up an ISIS truck that was laden with explosives outside of Misrata.
So Libya, Syria, which we've heard about. Anywhere else do you think we are?
Not that we have reports of, although, as I said, it's really difficult to tell with the blanket opacity.
No suspicions, though?
Always suspicions. I think wherever large terrorist organisations are operating and we need to control threats abroad, there's a chance that UK special forces will be used.
Is there not a temptation then for one simply to rebadge what a conflict is and what an intervention is?
Well, this is the problem in some ways. If you look at the deployment of special forces, they are quite exceptionally shrouded in secrecy. This culture of no comment that extends to media comments also extends to parliamentary questions. There has been no authorization of the use of military force in Libya. The authorization of the use of military force in Syria specifically precluded the deployment of ground troops. What we've just sort of got used to and what often passes under the radar is the fact that special forces don't count in those statements. And it's interesting to see how the role of the SAS and other special forces has been changing in recent years, almost in reaction to that. Other than in Afghanistan and Iraq, where they acted very much as force multipliers for regular troops that were on the ground, and those operations were scrutinised because there was a regular force presence, they're now operating as lone actors in places like Libya. And this isn't just for sort of kill and capture operations that last a very short amount of time. This can be sustained deployments now. And the upshot of this is really that entire remote wars can be carried out now by UK troops without the UK public consciousness that we're at war at all.
The retiring head of the Joint Special Operations Command, William McRaven, said, "We are in the golden age of special forces."
The golden age.
Yeah, the golden age. Lots of money, lots of resources. This raises a number of questions. The first one is, who decides on the deployment of special forces? Now, in America, they have a far more transparent system than we do. If special forces are deployed, the relevant armed forces and intelligence committees in the Senate and in the House of Representatives have to be informed. If UK special forces are deployed, nobody's informed. It's a high-level decision taken possibly by the Prime Minister with the Director of Special Forces, and this is the same in countries like Canada and Australia.
So Canada and Australia also have a blanket opacity policy. Yeah. I love this phrase. I'm going to keep it forever. Emily?
Slightly contrary to the complete opacity that the UK has, which means that there are no official statements about where the special forces are deployed, it's not unheard of for official spokespeople from US, Australian and Canadian administrations to comment on the deployment of special forces. Last year, in October, President Obama announced that he'd deployed the first long-standing special forces unit to Syria to combat ISIS.
Under what circumstances, therefore, do they decide to comment in one situation and not in another? What governs that?
Well, in the United States context, they are under a legislative rule. They have to comment. And that's largely the fallout from the Watergate scandal and the idea that intelligence should be brought more into the public domain. In countries like the United Kingdom and Canada and Australia, it's entirely by the choice of the political leaders. Harold Wilson famously in 1976 said, "I am sending the SAS to South Armagh because there have been a particularly series of brutal sectarian killings on both sides." And Wilson took the almost unprecedented step of saying, "I am sending the SAS in."
Even more famous than Prime Minister Harold Wilson's decision to send the SAS into South Armagh was his successor Margaret Thatcher's use of the force a few years later. In 1982, the Iranian embassy was taken over by terrorists. In front of television cameras, a team of SAS troops abseiled down the embassy building before forcing the way through the windows to rescue a group of hostages and kill or capture the hostage takers. And here in the briefing room, I have Robin Horsfall, who served in the SAS and was involved in that operation. Robin, what was your part in it?
I was one of the assault team members. It was my role to go in through the back door and take out the lower ground floor and secure the hostages and pass them out of the building. Things didn't go quite right at the beginning. We were compromised during our approach and we had to go in a bit quicker than we expected. We were going to use explosives, but we ended up using sledgehammers to go through the door. We went in, very, very quickly established control of the building, killed the terrorists and removed 19 hostages safely.
And how many of you were involved in that?
There was a squadron of us. There was about 40 of us that actually carried out the assault.
And how long had you been in the SAS before you took part in that operation?
Well, I was 23 years old at the time, and I got into the SAS just before my 22nd birthday. I'd only been in about a year, 18 months.
And had you role-played something like that before?
The squadrons rotated through the counter-terrorist role, four squadrons, each taking a six-month tour. We practiced every day, Monday to Friday, thousands and thousands of rounds, lots and lots of ammunition in order to be prepared for exactly that kind of scenario.
Now, how had you come to be in the SAS in the first place?
Well, I joined the army when I was 15 years old. did 2 years as a boy soldier, parachute regiment at 17. And by the time I was 20, I decided that I wanted something even more adventurous. And I applied for SAS selection. You have to do 3 years with a regular unit first. I turned up in 1978. It's a long process. A lot of people know about the first month, which is the month in the Brecon Beacons, where you're carrying heavier and heavier weights, starting at 35 pounds with a 15-mile march and building up gradually to the final march of 55 pounds and a 40-miler. You are on your own. You have no assistance. About 15% of the people that apply get through that first month. But then you
go 85% drop out after the first month.
Yeah. And then you go on to continuation training where you learn SAS tactics, you work very hard on their skills, and you learn how to use handguns, you learn how to do undercover work, and then you go off to the jungle for a month, and you live in the jungle in four-man teams in a month, getting eaten alive by everything. A few more will fail, and you go on to a combat survival course. The combat survival course ends up with the last week with you being chased by 1,000 men across the country, out there on your own with no food. And at the end of that period, you get interrogated. And if you pass that, if you're not a paratrooper, you go into a parachuting course. Then you're on probation for 6 months. And in the following 6 months, you have to learn a personal skill and a troop skill. Mine was paramedicine and my troop was a mountain troop. About a year has passed. If the guys are happier with you, they'll approve you to stay for another 2 years.
What are the qualities, actually, which you have to have?
You need to be driven by a deep-seated insecurity to prove yourself constantly. There's a sort of paranoia and fear of failure. A lot of my comrades, including myself, had poor relationships with male figures in the past, our fathers, our stepfathers, whatever it is. It is a particular type of individual who's above-average intelligence, who can learn skills and be able to think and work alone.
Now, it's some years since you went through that training. Do you think it's pretty much the same now as it was then?
There's a few small changes, but most of the selection process is the same. The quality of man is just as high. The amount of combat they've seen in the last 15 to 20 years was more than the period when I was serving, but the casualties they've taken and the reduction in numbers in the seed pool, the actual infantry that usually feed the SAS, has created some pressures.
Robin Horsfall, thank you. Please stay with us. Now let's remind ourselves of the history. The SAS has its origins in the North African campaign in the Second World War, and then afterwards went into decline. However, a new kind of threat led to its revival. Here's Anthony King, a special forces expert at the University of Warwick, to explain.
The critical moment is the 1972 Munich Olympic Games.
These are tonight's headlines. Israel, mourning its dead and angered at the killers, prepares to hold a state funeral tomorrow for the 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany.
Following the utter catastrophe and the utter unpreparedness of the German security forces and the German government for a terrorist attack, and of course Black September eventually killed 11 Israeli athletes, Western governments decided they needed a formalised and institutionalised counter-terrorist formation. In Britain, the SAS was given that role. And that is the moment at which they moved from a minor, irregular, rather sceptically viewed group of rogues into an absolutely central element in British security and defence.
And it was countering terrorism, says Anthony King, that remained the chief role of the special forces throughout the 70s and 80s, as we heard in operations such as the Iranian embassy siege, but also in operations in Northern Ireland and elsewhere. That changed in 1991.
The Gulf War was a moment where suddenly the potential for the Special Operations Force to provide a significant capability in conventional war fighting emerged.
Iraqi troops have invaded Kuwait and are reported to have taken over the capital, Kuwait City.
The story is that the SAS played a major role in Scud interdiction, and certainly they were very brave and very competent in terms of their operations.
We're at war. There's been an act of war declared upon America by terrorists, and we will respond accordingly.
The deployment of Special Operations Forces into Afghanistan occurred almost immediately after the 9/11 attacks. When Iraq started,
The original mission was particularly out in the desert, and they provided reconnaissance forces, and also in the north. They were essentially deployed into the peripheral areas while the main force attacked Baghdad. But once the American forces arrived in Baghdad, at that point, we get a really important moment in Special Forces history, namely a emerging counter-terrorist role. The rise of an insurgent terrorist movement, especially al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Baghdad and Ramadi and Fallujah in 2004, and it becomes the Special Operations Forces led by Delta Force and, in fact, the SAS to take apart this very lethal and effective terrorist organisation.
Anthony King bringing us almost up to date. Still with us is Robin Horsfall, former SAS soldier, as well as Emily Knowles of the Oxford Research Group and Dr. John Moran of the University of Leicester. Emily, we've just heard the history. Is this where we are at the present day? Instead of having the political cost of having squaddies in places where some of them come back as casualties and it becomes almost emotionally intolerable, that somehow or other, if you have this different kind of warfare, you can still be there, but you don't incur the same kind of costs.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at the impact of the engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan on this. I mean, you look at a UK public which is much more sceptical and averse to military interventions than in the past. There was a 2013 MOD document that was leaked about attitudes to risk. And it really stated that one of the ways to get around the fact that the UK public becoming more risk averse was to invest more in special forces. It's the only part of the armed forces, well, one of the only parts that is increasing rather than being reduced in size at the moment.
Right. And given what Robin Horsfall told us about the kinds of people who undertake these operations and so on, actually they are remarkably well set up and kind of psychologically primed to do this kind of thing, wouldn't you say, Robin?
Whichever capacity you put them in, they're there as technical advisors. So they're there to encourage and train local forces to do the job, so that our forces don't have to. Once we start to deploy regular forces onto the ground, wearing their berets, easily identifiable, that's when the scene changes. But by putting small numbers, usually in cases of less than eight, on the ground, you can actually have an effect and an influence without affecting the political setup.
Does anybody feel here that actually, somehow or other, the public is more likely to tolerate a casualty if it's a special force casualty?
I don't think any casualty is different in that way from another.
If
a special forces soldier dies and they don't identify him as a special forces soldier, they'll identify him with his parent unit. So they'll say a parachute regiment soldier died today. They won't say an SAS soldier. The public reaction to casualties today is much more intense than it has been in the past. The media do blow these casualties out of proportion and in many ways restrict what they're capable of doing, because we cannot fight wars without taking casualties.
Emily Knowles.
I would agree with you that casualties shouldn't be seen differently. But what was interesting in this 2013 MOD study that was leaked on attitudes towards risk was that it was quoted that the public have a more robust attitude to loss of special forces life than regular troops, and that was one of the reasons why investing more in them might be a way to get around the risk-averse attitudes of the general public.
Well, let's not be parochial. How do they do it across the Atlantic? Connecting into the briefing room from Charleston, South Carolina now, is Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Grenier. He retired a few years ago after a long career in the US Special Forces. Welcome, Lieutenant Colonel.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Tell us, what roughly do you have in terms of special forces in the United States?
The American Special Operations Forces are organized under the U.S. Special Operations Command, which consists of 70,000 personnel. Approximately 56,000 are active duty troops, 7,500 are reserve troops, and 6,500 are civilians. There's been significant growth, almost a doubling in size since 9/11.
We've heard about what happens in Britain, what we called the blanket opacity policy. But you don't have a blanket opacity policy. You in the States are relatively upfront about where you're going and when.
We do enjoy much more transparency with the deployment of our special operations forces, but that has really developed since 9/11. More broadly, American journalists enjoy significant First Amendment rights.
Got you. How has their use changed? In what kind of situations are they being used now that they weren't before?
There's been a significant increase in the ability of U.S. special operations to fuse intelligence and operations, the use of signals intelligence, overhead imagery, which would include the use of drones, the use of cyber operations and human intelligence. For instance, when Admiral McRaven, who was then the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, soon after the raid that resulted in the death of Osama bin Laden, that this was just one of many of the same type of raids that were conducted that night. So the ability to conduct lots of raids. They are conducting missions in areas such as Yemen, Colombia, Mali, Kenya. The list goes on, Mauritania, Lebanon, Libya. The American public assumes that U.S. Special Operations Forces are operating across the world.
Now, this is a difficult question for you to answer in some ways, but obviously it's what you call the $64 million question. Have they really made a significant difference?
Broadly, yes. The real question is was it a positive or a negative difference? It depends on who you ask. If you were to ask members of the special operations community or their supporters, they argue that special operations leaders have led to troops that made a positive difference in both in disrupting and destroying insurgent networks, as well as training and advising local indigenous forces. However, if you were to ask more conventional or regular military commanders, some would argue that special operations activity in Iraq and Afghanistan disrupted and caused problems, leaving the mess for the conventional forces to clean up.
Stephen Grenier, thank you very much indeed. Emily and John, does that chime in roughly with what you've perceived about British special force use? John?
There is still debate in British circles about the actual role and effectiveness of the SAS in Northern Ireland bringing the IRA to the negotiation table. If you look at the almost classic example of UK special forces operations in the last 15 years, it's in taking down the Al-Qaeda in Iraq car bomb networks. They were doing three or four raids a night to either arrest or liquidate Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, they may have killed 3,000 or 4,000 people and arrested another 12,000. That was seen as a tremendous success for British and American special forces. But if you look at the actual stabilisation of Iraq in the short and long term, the role of special forces becomes a lot more murky. It might be argued that the real stabilisation of Iraq came about with the awakening movement, where local militias were recruited and they started to turn against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So in other words, it became a Sunni-on-Sunni conflict. In addition to that, it was the actual fanning out of US military, the grunts on the ground in Baghdad, in Fallujah, that then brought local security. And if you look at the long term, it did nothing about preventing the rise of ISIS.
Emily Knowles, do you think that's right, that there's a danger here in these special forces? We like the notion of them, and that they represent a kind of military quick fix.
Yes, and I think there are two strands to that, really. And the first is that this blanket opacity and culture of no comment shoots the government in the foot a little when it comes to discussing how effective special forces activity has been over the last 10 to 15 years. It's very difficult to hold the government to account over actions that it won't admit it has committed. The second strand to this is the idea that special forces may be very good at some things, but may not be the answer to long-term instability in a lot of these places. Are we deploying it because it is the best possible response to a particular form of instability that we see? Or are we deploying special forces because it's politically expedient to do so? And I think that's very difficult to answer when it's impossible to get any information about where they've been used and what the goals were in sending them in to begin with.
Our time's up. Panel, thank you very much. I hope listeners feel themselves briefed. Now go and invade North Korea. Until next week, goodbye.
That's David Aronovich presenting The Briefing Room. The producer was me, Mike Wendling. The editor is Innes Bowen. If you liked what you heard, why not leave us a review? And you might also be interested in some other podcasts from the BBC. I'm a particular fan of The Inquiry from our colleagues at the BBC World Service. Thanks for listening.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.